Good morning. We're back for a new episode of Riddles in the Dark, a podcast sponsored by the Mythgard Institute and Middle Earth Network Radio. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and I'd like to introduce our host, Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor.
Good morning. Okay, so our first, of course, the piece of news which we announced last night is that we are finally sort of launching the second part, or sort of the wider part, of the Riddles in the Game, the Riddles in the Dark prediction game. Because the central idea is not only that we would have these podcasts where Dave and I speculate about this, though he and I enjoy that enough to do that all by itself, but the cooler thing is to invite other people to participate in this discussion, because, of course, this is one of the fun things to do. And I think this is a really cool opportunity. I mean, whenever a movie is coming out that you're really excited about, it's always fun to speculate about what it's going to be like and what's going to happen. But here you get to combine that with actual discussion of books that we love, too. So, I mean, like, what a twofer. So, anyway, we want to involve lots more people in this discussion. So, we have partnered with a bunch of other podcasts and other Tolkien websites. And if you go to Dave, where can they most easily find the link to the prediction grid that we've made up?
So what is the URL? I believe the URL, it's if you go to the Mythgard Institute webpage, there's this thing called the exclusive section, which is content exclusive to the Mythgard Institute, of course. And underneath there, you will see, if you highlight that menu option, you'll see Riddles in the Dark listed, and you click that. So that takes you to the Riddles in the Dark page. And then if you scroll down to the bottom, there's a thing that says prediction game, and there's a link buried in some text that says see everyone's guess in the predictions grid. If you click on that link, then that will take you to the page with our giant grid that has everybody's predictions in it right now. And so that's where you go to find out more.
Yeah, it should be fun. And so this is still kind of under development, and we're going to be kind of making this bigger and better as time goes along. But you can begin to see what some other people think about this, and we're going to be having some regular guest posts by our other partners who are working with us on this. Some of them will be text posts that will be posted not only on their websites, but also on our blog at Mythgard. And then also we'll be having some kind of audio digest posts. That is, some of the other podcasts are going to be discussing these questions too, and we're going to basically run the clips of them discussing it kind of in response to what we're talking about here, so you'll be able to hear what they have to say too. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
and
fun shall abound.
Our long-term goal is to be able to accept feedback from our listeners, so to do polls and things like that. Actually, I have a new harebrained idea. I would love to. I have no idea how much work this would be and whether I'll be actually be able to do this, but I would love to set up an actual prediction market, kind of like InTrade, where we
awesome.
Where people place bids on these things, and we measure the likelihood of things based on share prices.
Awesome. That sounds pretty cool.
That could be a while before we actually have that.
That sounds a little elaborate, but
yes.
Fun. That's pretty cool. Well, we have been getting some feedback from people, and we're always happy to hear what your thoughts are. So we hope to be able to put whatever apparatus we end up doing, some apparatus or other in place. That we can where we can actually register listener feedback on the site as well. So anyway, so that's sort of, it's still in progress, and that's what's coming along. So look for the contributions of our guests and partners on this too. So anyway, today our topic today, as we said last time, is the Battle of Azanulbazar. We've still been talking about we've been focusing on the dwarves here at the beginning. And after talking about Thrian and Thror, we came, especially after last week with our discussion of Thror himself, to the issue of the Battle of Azanulbazar. But we should actually we should start off with some of our listener feedback. There were a couple questions that people asked that I think that I would like to that I'd like to address. One actually is back to the Thrain issue, which there's been some discussion on the Tolkien Professor Facebook page about the comment Gandalf says that Thrain was witless and wandering when he found him. And I, you know, basically the discussion on the site was whether that means, that is the reference to his being, to his wandering, whether that means that there's any chance that the Necromancer actually let Thrain loose and he's actually like physically wandering around. And I guess like my response to that is twofold. On the one hand, I feel about 95% I feel about 98% positive that Gandalf simply means mentally wandering. I think that I think there's a less than 2% chance that Gandalf is implying that Thrain was out of prison when he met him, because he says he was in the pits, he was in the dungeons of Dol Guldur. So I don't think that's happening. Is there precedent for that? You know, for the big bad guy setting a prisoner free after he's basically gotten everything from him that he wants? Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happens to Húrin in the first stage with Melkor, but I don't see any parallel there, and I don't see any reason to think that Thrain's actually been set free. So as far as like my interpretation of that passage in the book, I don't at all think that that's what Gandalf means. I think he's just referring to his mental wandering. But the other way to approach that question is like, could it be done that way? And I think, yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, could I, you know, do I think that it would be possible to adapt the story in that way? Yes. I don't know that I'd do it, but then again, I wouldn't have open air prisons either in Dol Guldur. So what do I know? What do you think about that, Dave?
Well, that's a good question.
Thran question.
I thought that was a good point, because that's one of those, I think that's one of those phrases that oftentimes when I'm reading this book or listening to the audio version of it, that I kind of just skate over it. Like, I sort of wonder that too. Like, what does he mean, witless and wandering? And I think the mental image it usually conjures up for me is physically wandering, that somehow he was escaped or something, but I never spent a lot of time worrying about it. I just sort of kept going. And so this is an interesting discussion, and I hadn't considered the possibility that it was, that he was sort of using it metaphorically, you know, mentally wandering and not totally unfocused maybe. So, that was an excellent discussion on the page. But I agree. This seems like the ripe kind of opportunity, like Balrogs having wings, quote unquote, for example, where filmmakers might say, let's take this literally, or even worse, they just took it literally, not on purpose, but that's right, how they understood it. And
but
so
at least then we, and this is actually a major downside to directorial commentaries on DVDs, because until they actually explain what they were intending to do, I can attribute to them great ingenuity and brilliance for everything that they do. Like, I have that freedom until I actually hear them explain their reasonings. So I actually don't enjoy directors' commentaries for that reason. It's like, please just let me attribute to you.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Let me use my imagination.
it's really better. But anyway, the reasons I think in the text that he's clearly talking about mental wandering is because it's in that context when he says that he barely remembered his own name, and so I mean that's like, whatever. Are they going to do it differently? They may. I mean, and it certainly would. I don't know. I mean, it would make for an interesting scene. Like, I can certainly imagine such a scene being filmed, but it's kind of hard to imagine how they're going to explain, you know, like, oh yeah, they just kind of got bored and let me go. I don't know. I mean, there was a reason why Húrin was let go. And he wasn't just let go. He was set free so that they could watch him and learn stuff from him and hoping that he would do more harm. So I just don't see that angle working for Thrain. So who knows? Anyway, so that's one thing. The other question, Harold Johnson, that was Michael Lucero who posed that question originally on my Facebook page. Harold Johnson also had another question about the dwarf ring. Are we going to do an episode on the Dwarf Ring? This is reminding me. I'm thinking off the top of my head. Should we save this for a Dwarf Ring episode? Are we going to do that?
I think we should. I think that would be very fun. So I'd say we save this question.
Okay. All right. We'll save this one. See, I was going to address it, but then all of a sudden at the last second, I'm thinking, because we're going to talk about that soon, probably sooner rather than later, actually, to talk about the Rings of Power, because of course that's a big question. It was easy enough. I mean, we had the three rings, but they were appearing, sort of off the radar, in the Lord of the Rings. But really there was just the one central ring. We do have now, all of a sudden, a dwarf ring in issue here. So that does raise a different question. But anyway, okay. So we'll come back to that. All right. So then let's get to the Battle of Azanul.
Well, maybe before that, I just wanted to maybe discuss a little bit some of the feedback we've gotten from our guest analysts from the prediction game. We won't read. We got lengthy. Almost essay quality content from Mark Fisher from the Encyclopedia of Arda, and also some good stuff from American Golden Star from Casual Stroll. But we won't read it on here because I'm thinking actually either we'll post it as a blog or maybe even I can read it and record it and include it in our digest episode, which we still haven't released, but we will soon, I promise. Mm-hmm. But I think Mark brought up a good point that we didn't cover when we were talking about the potential of Thrain and Thror stories being told in flashbacks and all that, which I think people, maybe it's easy to forget with The Hobbit, but this whole movie is technically going to be a flashback already.
Right.
And so whenever we start talking about flashbacks, other flashbacks, we're getting into flashbacks of flashbacks. And
right.
I don't know how – I mean, I don't think that means they won't do them, but that certainly makes them slightly more complicated and kind of strange.
I agree, though it also does, as he was pointing out, raise the – actually increase the possibility of flashbacks as long as they happen within that larger frame. And, of course, the larger frame he's talking about is Bilbo relating these stories to Frodo, which we are reminded of – obviously, not only by the casting of Elijah Wood, but also by the trailer. You know, the reference in the trailer, which Mark alludes to, of old Bilbo saying that he hasn't told him all, which does lead us to believe. The whole idea of a frame story, which is even in the original Hobbit. I mean, the whole thing isn't framed beginning and end in the Hobbit, but at the end of the book in the last chapter, we do see Bilbo writing his memoirs. We do see Bilbo writing down the story that we just finished reading. He doesn't have an audience. He doesn't have Frodo there because, of course, in 1937, Frodo didn't exist, but he is writing his memoirs. He is writing the Red Book. And that, I think, is a really important thing. This is one of the things that I love most. I mean, I remember when Elijah Wood was cast, when that announcement was made, and, Tolkien fans all over were groaning and saying, what on earth are they doing casting Frodo in The Hobbit? And I loved it for this reason, because I love frame stories. And I think that one of the coolest things about The Hobbit, and its role, especially when you're telling it from the Lord of the Rings context, is this idea of its being a story within a story. So having it framed in that way, even more aggressively than The Lord of the Rings was, with the book writing at the beginning and end as they did it in the extended edition, I think that that's great. So that could work really well and, provide a frame wherein they tell a bunch of things, which would be, sort of more orderly flashbacks rather than a flashback interrupting the narrative, having this sort of stream of things. It certainly allows them to do initial exposition pretty easily in the same way that they did the initial exposition in the Lord of the Rings films, the original voiceover sequence. But it would be less out there. I mean, of course, the thing with the Lord of the Rings films, you just start with a dark screen and Galadriel's voice and no context for that. And we don't even know who that is.
Yes.
Until we meet her later on. Now, that's a cool effect. I'm not criticizing that. But here, of course, we have a much more natural frame context and opportunity for flashback and exposition like the flashback and exposition that we got at the beginning of the Lord of the Rings. Now, with the Hobbit frame, though, I think here's the way I disagree with the flashback point, is that I doubt they're going to make the frame very intrusive. that is, I suspect, is going to come at the beginning and it's going to come in at the end, but I don't expect it to interrupt the story. Like The Princess Bride, for instance, you know, where, like, we keep interrupting the story and going back to the storytelling frame.
So you don't think that they'll be, like, doing a scene and then suddenly we'll hear Frodo's voice saying, "What? That happened?" And then
you
go back to Frodo and Bilbo talking, and Bilbo's like, "Yes, of course."
Right. That would be one way to do it. And I say it was done brilliantly in The Princess Bride film. I mean, that's the best storytelling frame and relationship between frame and framed story film that I can think of. It was fantastically done in that film. My prediction, not that we're making an official prediction about that, but I don't think they're going to do it that way. I think they're going to do a beginning and ending frame.
Yeah, I agree that I don't think they'll interrupt. I think if anything, maybe we'll occasionally get narration from Bilbo. In fact, I expect we'll get that pretty regularly, introducing scenes maybe, but
like an Ian Holm voiceover, basically.
Yes.
That does seem reasonable. But since that's the case, if we don't, so long as we don't return to the frame in the middle and it's just a beginning and ending thing, the whole rest of the films are not going to feel like a flashback. I mean, it's going to feel, you're going to be immersed in that story. So having a flashback within that story that you're immersed in, despite the fact that it's a framed narrative, I don't think is gonna feel weird. It's not like a really confusing flashback in a flashback kind of effect. So I think as long as they handle the frame in that way, it's not gonna be. I don't think it's gonna preclude flashbacks. But it was a really interesting point. I hadn't really been thinking about that all that much, so I was really glad he brought that up.
All right. Good. Okay. Battle of Azanulbazar.
All right.
Let's get on with it.
Let's do this. Okay, so
I was thinking that maybe a nice first thing to start with would be where is Azanulbazar? Talk a little bit about just the location itself.
Yep. Well, the Battle of Azanulbazar, of course, will be recognized by the readers of The Lord of the Rings. That's the place where they come out of Moria. When they come out, the front gate, and and run down towards Lorien. That's the valley of Azanulbazar that they come down into. And, of course, you'll remember that Gimli, even though they're being pursued by orcs – well, I mean, like, they're about to be pursued by orcs. They're running away from orcs. He has to stop and pay homage to Khaled Zaram, the pool. Because this is, one of the sacred sites of the dwarves. This is the place where, this is the Miramir. And there's a stone there marking the spot where Durin first looked in Miramir. This is a huge deal. So it's in that valley that the Battle of Azanulbazar happens. So I think that that's an important thing to remember, that this battle, it's not just that it is fought for the, kind of, in a sense, over the Mines of Moria, that is that the Mines of Moria are the battleground for this, the ancestral home of the chief of the dwarf families. But it is also being fought literally at this site, at this, most sacred of dwarven places, at least most sacred of dwarven places that we ever hear about. That's a really big deal, I think.
And it's just to refresh our listeners' minds, in Elvish, this valley is referred to as Nanduhirion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the men call it Dimrildale.
That's right. Yes, it's one of those places, and there are several of the places around Moria, like the Three Mountains, that we are given their translations, names in all three languages.
Which is a signpost back to the good old days when everybody got along and there was...
that's right. That's right. Which is, of course, significant because, we know that, dwarves don't share their secret language with anybody. Remember what a big deal Gimli felt that it was when he heard Galadriel speaking the names of Khazad-dûm and Khaled-Zaram in his own language. But of course, those are some of the few places where the dwarven words for things are known, because they used to be in friendship, in community. It is a sign of like those open days.
Yep.
You'll note, for instance, we don't know the dwarven name for the Lonely Mountain. We're never given that. you know, Erebor is not a dwarvish name, and the Lonely Mountain is what the men call it. So anyway,
is Erebor elvish?
Yes.
And I know our more meticulous listeners will want us to specify which elvish these words are.
It is Sindarin.
Yeah, it's nearly. I think most of the elvish words in general that we get in these books are Sindarin, right?
Yes.
Cool.
Yep.
Okay, so the battle.
Especially the place names.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the place names in Middle-earth. But
right.
Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so the battle, I thought maybe we would start by reading. There's the paragraph that describes the beginning of the battle is really kind of a fun one. It's in the Appendix A, so I thought maybe we would read that. What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
All right, here we go. Actually, it's not the whole pair. I'm skipping the first sentence. So okay. Began the Battle of Azanulbazar, or Nanduhirion in the Elvish tongue, at the memory of which the orcs still shudder and the dwarves weep. The first assault of the vanguard led by Thryne were thrown back with loss, and Thryne was driven into a wood of great trees that then still grew not far from Kelidzarum. There Frerin his son fell, and Fundin his kinsman, and many others, and both Thryne and Thorin were wounded. Elsewhere the battle swayed to and fro with great slaughter, until at last the people of the Iron Hills turned the day. Coming late and fresh to the field, the mailed warriors of Nine, Gror's son, drove through the orcs to the very threshold of Moria, crying, "Azog, Azog," as they hewed down with their mattocks all who stood in their way. I love that line about the orcs shuddering and the dwarves weeping.
Yes. That's my favorite line in that paragraph. Absolutely. So this is now, the interesting thing about the Battle of Azanulbazar. I mean, it's sort of its history in the stories of the book. That is, all of the elements of the Battle of Azanulbazar are there in The Hobbit. In the 1937 Hobbit, they're all there. The fact that the dwarves fought a war against the goblins, that war was fought for vengeance over the death of Thror, that Azog the goblin murdered Thror, and that they were taking vengeance for that, and that Azog was killed by Dan's father. All of those things are mentioned in The Hobbit. So it's all there in the original story, but it's only, you know, I mean, it's, and I mentioned this in our first episode, I think, we don't really get a glimpse, we don't really get a sense at all in that first chapter where these things are originally mentioned in The Unexpected Party, a sense of what a big deal this was. It sounds like, because we don't know what the Mines of Moria are. We don't even know that those are big. I mean, Mines makes it sound like it's not actually really, you know, that big a deal. Like, mm-hmm. So there were some mines. We fought some goblins there. I mean, okay, whatever. But we begin to learn the moment we meet the great goblin and realize that he has heard of Thorin and that this war was actually a really big deal, is the first time that we begin to see the scope of it. So the full story told in Appendix A is really just fleshing out things that have been there all along. So for this reason, the Battle of Azanulbazar is kind of pretty deeply woven into the backstory of The Hobbit as it's conceived in the original book, which is one good reason to include it in the film. Another good reason to include it in the film is that it's awesome, and it's sort of part of exactly the kind of thing that the film seems to be interested in doing, that is playing up the more sweeping, epic versions of the Hobbit story that Tolkien was developing later on in the post Lord of the Rings era. So this exact kind of material from Appendix A seems to be a lot of the stuff that they're working with in making up the films.
Yeah, I agree. As I've been thinking about how they're going to do this film, and in particular that point you brought up about them turning this into a more sort of epic delivery of the story of the Hobbit, I really think one of the elements they're going to play up is the enmity between the goblins and the dwarves, because,
yes.
The Hobbit is kind of, it's, there's so many different stories buried in it. You know, it's on the surface, it really appears to be just about Bilbo and this unexpected journey. When we read The Quest for Erebor in the appendix of Lord of the Rings, we start to see that it's kind of a first, it's a prelim for the War of the Ring, and it sets a lot of important events in motion. But what it also is it's really kind of a culmination of this, of the war of the dwarves and the orcs. And the Battle of Five Armies is kind of this, encore to the Battle of Azanulbazar. So I think they're going to really try to play up that whole, the dwarves orcs war. And I think they're really, I think that's, cause that's a, you know, with all this backstory on the dwarves, that's an excellent opportunity to mine for epic elements.
Right. Because, I mean, one challenge that I think is definitely going to confront them, I mean, obviously, Battle of Five Armies is going to be a big deal in the second film. Like, you know, that's pretty much the most obvious thing on Earth. Here, Peter Jackson is being handed this enormous epic battle at the end of the story. But in the Battle of Five Armies, the sort of the crucial context of the Battle of Five Armies is that the enmity of the dwarves and the elves against the goblins is so intense that although they are actually running across the field towards each other, about to hack into each other, arrows have already been shot. You know, so like they are seconds away from hacking into each other. The goblins appear. They immediately stop, turn 90 degrees, metaphorically, you know, step shoulder to shoulder and fight against the goblins together. Like that kind of incredible, radical shift in the dynamics of what is happening from I am running at you screaming and holding an axe to now you are my friend and ally and I shall strategize with you to defeat our common foe. I mean, that is a jolt that requires a lot of belief. Now, I think it works in The Hobbit, but on film, that's going to be hard to do. And I think that what's going to be really crucial to doing that is exactly what you say. If we can establish first the kind of fundamental reality of the enmity between the dwarves and the goblins, then that will really help. Of course, also, you're going to have to establish it between the elves and the goblins, too. Because that's something which, in the book, Tolkien asks us just to take on faith.
Yeah, he just slips that line in at the end, right?
Says their hatred for the goblins was bitter.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
Right, exactly. Now, I mean, if you read really carefully, the only setup we get for it are the references to the fall of Gondolin. Like, we know that the ancient wars between the elves and the goblins, and which, of course, is we are reminded of in the fact of the magic swords, right? With Beater and Biter and that is the goblins' reactions to Glamdring and Orcrist and with Sting as well. So we have heard that there were elf and goblin wars, and they were legendary and they were amazing and it was tragic and Gondolin fell. But we do have that set up, but it's pretty distant, and it's only brought up a couple times. And as I say, you have to pay attention to really be remembering that, to be thinking about Gondolin, when the elves form ranks against the goblins. So yeah, I mean, I think for the film, they're going to need a little bit more than a couple references to the fall of Gondolin thousands of years ago.
That's a good point. I wonder if maybe they could do things like, when the elves capture the dwarves and they're interrogating them, one of the things they maybe ask about is movements of the goblins or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, at least some reference to it there. I mean, it's hard because the Battle of Azanulbazar does present a kind of obvious opportunity to set up the terrible enmity. And not only that, but to establish parallels with the Battle of Five Armies so that you can have one could, theoretically, have these two battles framing the story in the same way that Peter Jackson used the Battle of the Last Alliance and the Battle Before the Gates of Mordor as a framing structure for the Lord of the Rings story as well, with the sort of some fairly clear recapitulatory moments in the, you know, the Stand, Men of the West, business at the end of the Return of the King, looking back towards the opening sequence. Serious movie fans will remember, in the initial cuts, like not just the initial concept, but in the initial filming of that battle before the gates of Mordor in the Return of the King, they had actually filmed it. They had actually intended it to have Sauron come out and fight hand-to-hand with Aragorn on the battlefield before the gates. And they cut that. So that's like...
Thank God.
The troll that he fights against there at the end was Sauron originally, and they replaced CG Sauron with CG troll instead. Anyway, that was cool with it. But again, forgetting whether or not that's a terrible idea, what we can clearly see happening there is the frame, right? That we have Sauron coming out into the battle, just like he came out into the battle at the beginning of the first movie. We see him fighting with Aragorn as he fought with Elendil and Isildur. So that concept is clearly there. That framing concept is clearly there. You could do a very similar thing. The Battle of Azanul Bazar does present itself as an obvious kind of framing mechanism for the film, and a good setup, which could be a good setup in several ways, visually as well as thematically, for the Battle of Five Armies. So that could happen, but of course, here's the problem. I think here's the other challenge. Is that the story of The Hobbit has another frame too, and that is the attack of Smaug on the Lonely Mountain. Because that's the other way that you could frame the story, of course. If you're starting the story with the unexpected party, that's the first frame. Like, we're not going to do the unexpected party and be like, and let's spend a whole lot of time talking about the Battle of Azanul Bazar. That's not the point of the unexpected party. The point of the unexpected party is Smaug and his attack on the Lonely Mountain. So that is the other logical place. If you want to start with a framing sequence to contextualize the story that's about to be told, in many ways, the attack of Smaug on Erebor is the more logical one of the two. Because it's the immediate story. It sets up the immediate story of the quest for the Lonely Mountain. And therefore, the Battle of Azanul Bazar and the attack of Smaug and the Battle of Five Armies, this is like one major epic event too many, I fear.
Yeah,
I wonder.
I've been worrying about that as well, that with all we're all excited about the fact that Peter Jackson is sort of continuing Tolkien's efforts toward the end of his life of incorporating The Hobbit into the larger epic world. But I've been worrying about this too, that we're going to get sort of epic clutter. We're going to get a clutter of epicness as he keeps adding all these things. And like, let's add in the history of the dwarves. Let's add in Thrain and Thror, and add in the Battle of Azanul Bazar and the War of the Orcs and Goblins, and also keep Smaug in there. Bilbo.
And we have to vastly expand the elves too. I mean, the wood elves are like a bit part in the book. We need much more of them, and we need, like, we've got Toriel, and like, I know that there's a lot of animus against Toriel among Tolkien fans, but I mean, honestly, I consider something like Toriel almost a necessity. I mean, other than the Elven King himself, we as readers have almost no connection with the Wood Elves. They are very distant. I mean, we're not connected with them. They wouldn't, as they're depicted, they wouldn't work on film. So presenting a sort of central Wood Elf character that we as viewers are led to care about is actually a very sensible, film response to that situation. So it doesn't surprise me. And if you have to construct and expand a character anyway, why not make it a female character since there aren't any in The Hobbit? That seems like a perfectly logical choice to me, I have to say. Much better than like converting somebody else into a woman in order to put a female on stage. So I mean that's whatever. Like I said, it's not perfect, but I can totally understand reason. If that is their reasoning, I can totally understand their reasoning for it.
Yes.
But anyway, as you say, yes. There's. I mean, this is kind of the irony, right? I mean, the first response. I mean, many people's first response when they hear that Peter Jackson is doing two epic films on The Hobbit is, how on earth are you going to get two epic films out of that tiny little book? And of course, now here in our discussion, we're like, the problem is the story of The Hobbit is far too epic.
Yeah, there's too much epic.
Two films. Right. Yeah. It's,
But we'll speaking of Epic, we need to get back to the topic of this episode.
Yes.
We actually haven't even described much about the Battle of Azanul Bazaar. We haven't even given our chance to wax lovingly about all the various things we like about the battle. So let's get back to that. Just some basics. The inciting event, of course, as we talked last time, is Thror's death at the hands of Azog, and not just death, but like brutal, probably torture and murder and beheading. And then desecration of the body afterward. And this incites not just this battle. This battle is actually the final battle of a, I think, 9-year war between the dwarves and the goblins. Right? And we're told that this war takes place mostly sort of, most of this war not only happens off screen, that we're not told what's going on in the book, we just told there's a war, but specifically that the war takes place sort of in many unseen, dark, and deep places under the earth. And so this is really, I guess this is the only battle that anybody really knows anything about apart from the dwarves, because the rest of it was just taking place completely out of sight. And it's said that this was a pretty brutal war too. And a lot of goblins and orcs and a lot of dwarves died.
Yes. And, you know, merciless, you know, that basically there was not a whole lot of, kindness on either side, that there were, you know, there were what would be considered war crimes happening on both sides. I mean, it was not a friendly war, and neither of them were very merciful or kindly. I mean, it was a nasty, brutal war.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the culmination of it. But the point of it is personal against Azog himself. The dwarves are fighting this war not to exterminate the goblins, but to hunt down Azog. So they went through and they took out every orc hold that they could find in the entire Misty Mountains, searching for Azog. So they were not going to give up butchering goblins until they found him. And that's why the dwarves of the Iron Hills come into the battle chanting Azog, Azog, because he's the one that they're looking for, and he's there. And Nyan, Dan's father, fights him and is killed by him right in the door of Moria. Until Dan Ironfoot comes up and kills him.
Right. And, of course, we shouldn't leave out the wonderful taunts that go back and forth between Nyan and Azog, too.
Yes.
What is it? Let's see. Nyan says, Azog, if you are in, come out. Or is the play in the valley too rough? And Azog's response is, what? Yet another beggar at my doors? Must I brand you too?
Yes.
This is an extremely personal war, isn't it?
It is. It is. And this is that moment. I mean, this is the thing that kills me about the Battle of Azanul Bazaar, thinking about the movies. It is very theatrical. The entrance of Azog there, as you know, the battle is happening and he's calling out from the darkness. He's still holding back and commanding his army from the rear not to put himself in jeopardy. You know, this, what, another beggar at my door? Must I brand you too? And then he steps out into the light and he's huge and really scary and awful. And then he and Nan have this, like, you know, great individual duel. And Azog kills him, and it's like, I mean, like the whole thing, it's a very theatrical sequence, that whole mm-hmm. sequence. Like you barely have to do anything to it. It would be awesome. And of course one of the crucial things about the Battle of Azanul Bazaar, one of the things that, makes it hard if anyone were woefully inclined to ditch it entirely, one of the difficulties is this is where the names come from. Thorin Oakenshield is called Thorin Oakenshield because of the battle of – at this battle, his shield was broken, and so he takes his axe and he lops off the branch of an oak tree, and he wields the oak club in his left hand to use it as both a shield and a club. That's where he gets his nickname, Thorin Oakenshield. And Dan Ironfoot gets his nickname, Ironfoot. This is why in the recent casting announcement of Billy Connolly as Dan,
I was most interested that he was officially called Dan Ironfoot, because I wanted to see if they would keep the Battle of Azanul Bazaar inspired name of Dan. And this is from Dan is the one who goes up and he kills Azog and puts his foot on his neck. So, I mean, this is Dan's big moment. And of course, Dan is also the one who is coming in like Nan does. Well, you know, Dan is there too in the Battle of Azanul Bazaar. The dwarves of the Iron Hills come marching in again at the Battle of Five Armies, and you know, and Dan is there. Though we're not really told anything about what he does at the Battle of Five Armies in the book. Dan, that is, you know, we aren't told any of his particular deeds, but he is the one who actually completes the vengeance of the dwarves. It's not Thorin, both Thran and Thorin are there at the battle. But neither one of them are the ones who avenge their kinsmen, their father and grandfather. It's Dan who does it, avenging his own father, who was just killed, you know, minutes before by Azog. Mm-hmm. And Dan is really young. I mean, he's like the equivalent of a dwarven teenager at this battle. So, anyway, lots of really cool stuff there. And of course, the memorial of it, the way that it's remembered by the dwarves. At the end of the battle, so many dwarves have been killed. They suffered about 50% casualties. So many dwarves have been killed that they can't bury them all because, as Tolkien explains in Appendix A, dwarves will not bury their dead in earth, but only in stone. And they don't have time to carve stone tombs for all of the dwarves who have been killed. So they burn their bodies. They make a huge funeral pyre and burn them all, though that was not at all their custom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how it's memorialized afterwards that, I love this phrase, like, you know, that dwarves need only say of their ancestor, he was a burned dwarf, and it is enough. And that is, if I could have one request about the Battle of Azanul Bazaar, I just want the phrase "burned dwarf" to be dropped at some point in
some
the film.
Point
it doesn't
in the
even
film.
Have to be explained. Can I just have somebody make reference to a burned dwarf? That would be cool. I don't think that particular wish is going to be granted, but that's what I would really love to see.
So they said that they cut down a ton of trees in the valley, and ever after remain bare, I guess, right up until the time the Fellowship walked through it, and also that the reek of the burning could be seen in Lorien.
Yes. Yeah. So
I hope even if they don't depict it, I just would like someone to say the words "burn dwarf." That would make me immensely happy.
And yeah, exactly.
So on the vengeance thing, I think another interesting thing to point out about the end of this is that, you know, right at the end, Thran is all excited. You know, he's lost an eye, and he's stumbling around. He's got a leg wound, but he says, you know, "Good, we have victory. Khazad Dûm is ours." But the others are, the other dwarves are remind him, "No, we fought this war for vengeance, and we did get vengeance, but we're not taking Khazad Dûm. Nobody's going to be able to get Khazad Dûm this time around. Right. You know, that's not why we're here. And even if we wanted to, we wouldn't be able to retake it because Durin's Bane is still there."
Right. Right. I love the line where, yeah, Thran is like, "And Moria is ours." And they say, "Even with one eye, you should see more clearly."
Yes.
yes. Exactly.
And I also, I like, let's see, where is the phrase I'm looking for? Right at the end of that answer from the dwarves, they say, "If this is victory, then our hands are too small to hold it."
Yeah,
it's another great phrase. So much good stuff in this, just this like short 3-page section.
yeah, it is. You know, and this is the short version of Appendix A. This, you know, of the Quest of Erebor stuff, I'll start it off as part of this appendix.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is the trimmed down version.
Just a kind of a curiosity. Do we get a bit of prophecy from Thran, or not Thran, from Dain at the end there, where he says, "The world must change, and some other power than ours must come before Durin's folk walk again in Moria"?
Yep. I think that is, I mean, it's a pretty cryptic, it's a pretty general prophecy that is, you know, it's, he's not making any terribly specific predictions there, but yes, yes, he is, and that's a kind of an interesting, I mean, in fact, it's not just interesting, it's quite remarkable for a dwarf, to say that. I mean, that's an admission that's going to kind of hurt for the dwarves, to say, you know, we can't retake our ancestral home ourselves. We're going to need help. Some other power than ours is going to have to come before we can do that. I mean, this is, you know, the passage this makes me think of is a passage from chapter one of The Hobbit when Gandalf is telling Thorin and the rest of them, and they're learning about this for the first time, about Thran's imprisonment by the necromancer and his death. You know, and Thorin says, well, we've already settled the goblins of Moria. Maybe now we should take thought for the necromancer. Like, we should, you know, he killed my father. We should take vengeance on him just the same. Let's have another dwarf war where we attack the necromancer. And Gandalf says, you know, no, that's really, that's a non-starter idea. You know, he is a foe that is far beyond you. Well, you know, so basically that's this. We see that kind of thinking. He's not intimidated by the necromancer. He's you know, ready to at least talk about going after him. But obviously, they're not. They wouldn't be able to conquer him, and they're certainly not going to be able to conquer the Balrog either. But not that they know exactly what the Balrog is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, yeah. So I mean, that recognition that. They have vengeance that needs to be taken. They have their own inheritance that is being held against them, and that they don't have the power by themselves to reclaim it. That's a bitter thing for dwarves, clearly. So Dan's recognition there, his, you know, prophetic if non-specific recognition of that, is a very, as I said, it's a tough thing for him and a significant admission on his part.
Yes. Although he was a pretty, we may have to do an episode about him down the road, but he is actually a fairly remarkable character. He turns out to be pretty, I mean, really, really important and also, and like good too.
Yes.
Like he really is, I mean, you know, Thorin's an awesome character, but I suspect that Dan's probably a better king under the mountain than Thorin would have been.
Yeah, all's well as ends better.
Yes.
yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. But okay, so.
So now we need to talk about.
Yeah, we need to face.
The shadow and the threat that's been growing in our sleep.
Exactly, yes. And this is basically the idea that I thought of quite spontaneously in the middle of our last broadcast, which was are they going to just roll the Battle of Azanul Bazar and the Battle of Five Armies together in the film? Because, of course, that's one way to get rid of – that would be one way to solve the problem of we have all of this epic material, but we have too much epic material, is to take the epic material from the Battle of Azanul Bazar and just import it into the Battle of Five Armies. The description of the Battle of Five Armies is sketchy enough, that is, it's limited enough, that – you know, you could still add a whole bunch of things there. You could do, you know, you could conceivably have, you know, Dan kill. Well, so first of all, you've got the Azog-Bolg issue, right?
Yep.
Azog is the guy killed in the Goblin King killed in the Battle of Azanul Bazar, and Bolg is his son, who is leading the goblins in the Battle of Five Armies. As Gandalf reminds the dwarves, he reminds Dan, Bolg, whose father Azog you killed in Moria, is here leading this goblin army. And I think there that, you know, some people were trying to reassure us that they can't possibly be combining Azog and Bolg because Bolg has already been cast, but that is not true. The Great Goblin is cast. That is the Great Goblin that they kill when they are captured, that Gandalf kills, at least in the book Gandalf kills him. That's the guy who's been cast.
Yes, and to the extent one person on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, proposed the idea that maybe the Goblin King was the same as Azog or the same as Bolg, but I think it's interesting to note that if you look at Barry Humphrey's casting information on IMDb, he's playing the Goblin King in the first film, And then he's playing some random other character named Gorkin in the second film. Yeah. So I believe that's a confirmation that the Goblin King was not going to survive past the first film.
Right, right, exactly. As we are definitely going to have a killing of the Great Goblin in film one.
Yes, so and as far as I can tell, Bolg has not been cast yet. He's certainly not listed on IMDb, and I haven't seen any announcements on any of the major news sites or any rumors, yeah. So... I think that's a very – I think there's a lot of potential for this idea that that maybe somehow Azog escaped whatever version of the Battle of Azanulbazar happens to be at the beginning of the film, and that he's going to show up again at this fight, and that the revenge – this whole revenge against Azog thing will be moved into the Battle of Five Armies. I think that's an interesting idea.
It's possible – theoretically possible, and you can tell by my tone of voice how excited I am about this idea, that the enmity between the dwarves and the goblins could simply be established by the killing of the Great Goblin, by Thorin and company and Gandalf in the middle of the movie, or, you know, in the first movie, so that instead of having the Battle of Azanulbazar corresponding with the Battle of Five Armies, we could have the Battle of Five Armies just referring back to that first encounter in movie one, the encounter between Thorin and company and the Great Goblin. So that is possible. You could do it that way without putting the enmity between dwarves and goblins in this broader historical context that the Battle of Azanulbazar gives. I hate that idea, but I can imagine it working on film. Certainly the reduction in Goblin Kings would probably be seen as a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Bolg might be one Goblin King too many. That would give us three.
Yeah, I was going to say, goblins aren't particularly – it's hard. I think we don't do a good job. I don't think we perceptually will be able to tell the difference between all these different main goblin orc characters. And I think if we get one too many named goblin characters and they're each on screen for about 2 minutes, it does seem like a – it seems like a bit much. So yes, one thing. So here's the question: what would be the good elements from Azanulbazar that could be, or we would like to see imported in the Battle of Five Armies, particularly if not importing them means they get left out? Obviously, Dan killing Azog or whoever would be cool.
Right. Yeah,
obviously, the various characters like Nan and Thran and those people cannot be included in this battle.
Right.
Because they're dead. They don't have to kill Nan,
could
do
they? Thran can't be there.
Yes.
But Nan could be. He could conceive. Inconceivably, I doubt that it would happen. Especially since they haven't cast him, right?
Yeah, so and that's one too many dwarf characters, too.
Well, right. We can't have too many dwarf kings either, or dwarf leaders anyway, dwarf captains. So Nan is probably out too, but we can now. Of course, the problem with having an epic, because Azog and his bodyguard give Thorin his mortal wound in the battle in the books, so one could easily imagine a culminating sequence of Thorin fighting hand to hand against Azog and being mortally wounded,
mm-hmm.
and then Dan coming in and killing Azog, in a Battle of Azanulbazar-esque manner. But of course, the question here is, what then do you do with the gigantic bear who is the one who kills the Goblin King who kills Bolg in the book?
That's what I was going to say. That's the thing we'll lose. We're going to lose Bjorn killing Bolg, which...
And there's an approximately 0% chance that we're going to lose Bjorn.
Yes.
Now, seriously, we're going to pass up the opportunity for a gigantic monster bear to plunge into this battle? Come on.
So suppose they were to keep... Azog and Bolg. Maybe Bolg isn't named or featured, but there'll be some goblin character who's kind of a little bit bigger and wearing better armor than the other characters, and then we get to see the giant bear kill him, and then later on, when we're going through the credits of the movie, we'll be like, oh, that was Bolg.
They make Bulg just like a red shirt, basically. Yes. He's like a goblin red shirt.
Yes.
I could see almost as an inside joke, just sort of like listing one of them as Bulg. Like, you know, there you go, purists. See, he did it. Like, that would satisfy anybody. Maybe. I mean, you know, but see, the thing is that you can still have Bjorn come in and have a, you know, a massive effect on the battle without having him be the one to kill Azog. Because basically, I doubt that that's going to work with the story as they're going to tell it. I mean, it's Bjorn descends on the battle. In the book, of course, it happens off stage. We're only told about it afterwards. We don't see Bjorn coming into the battle. Bilbo's unconscious when it happens. But from what we hear of it, Bjorn descends on the Battle of Five Armies like the fist of God.
Yes.
Like a meteor opening a crater in the goblins. And so, I mean, he can have that kind of effect, but I don't expect, as much as I expect Peter Jackson to relish the opportunity to have a monstrous werebear throwing goblins around in the battle, I can't imagine him just having Bjorn come in and basically single-handedly take over everything in the way that he basically does in the book. And because that would be...
It'll look hokey on film. It'll be too Deus Ex Machina.
Yes, exactly. And it will... And less personal. You know, he's... I don't think they're going to... I mean, I don't know. You know, Bjorn's character is, of course, another discussion topic for another week. But I think that, like, basically his own... His he's not going to have enough personal reason. You know, there's no, like, you killed my father, prepare to die element of Bjorn attacking the great goblin, you know, or, you know, attacking Azog. This, I'm all full of the Princess Bride today. Anyway, I don't see that happening for that reason. Like, having Thorin and Dayan fighting against him makes much more sense, I think, in that way. So I can see that. I can imagine this.
It's fun to speculate about these battles.
Yes it is. But the cruel truth is, I think that the rolling together idea works uncomfortably well.
Yes.
Ever since I suggested that, I've been considering it with increasing horror, because I think it's actually really quite plausible. Now, one element from Azanul Bazar, which I don't think could be non-hokily worked into the Battle of Five Armies, is the Oakenshield thing. I believe has that name all the way through. He certainly does in the book. And I don't think they're going to wait to introduce him as Oakenshield until the end of the film, the end of the second film either.
Give him that name after he's dead.
Right, exactly. And in memoriam, we shall remember him as Thorin Oakenshield.
I think at that point they'll be remembering him as Thorin King Under the Mountain.
I think he'd rather
have that title.
Yeah, a nice jaunty nickname is not really what he needs on his deathbed. There,
no,
so.
I kind of agree. I was going to mention that this podcast is kind of therapeutic in a way. I think it's preparing me to accept all of these changes.
yes, exactly.
Because you're right. As much as I sort of hated the idea initially of them rolling these things together, as we talk it through, I'm like, yeah, I guess I really don't see any other way they can do this.
Yeah, I mean,
this makes complete sense.
Darn it! I mean, I can see it. I can still imagine. I can see in my mind's eye, not a full beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, Battle of the Last Alliance treatment of the Battle of Azanul Bazar. I can imagine flashbacks. I can see it happening. Allusions back to it to set up the backstory. If they do choose that they want more than just the killing of the Great Goblin by Thorin Gandalf and company. If they want more than that to build up the animosity between the dwarves and the goblins, then, you know, cool. Then you could go there. You could do that. Mm-hmm. But but you can't, I don't know. I mean, I doubt it would be the whole thing. I doubt they would really do, they would really do the full show as much as I would long for them to do it.
I can even imagine them having the, War of the Last Alliance, Fellowship of the Ring style beginning. Probably not, because I think that will be the dragon. But I could imagine them doing it. I'm increasingly thinking the choicest morsels from the battle, the best scenes or confrontations. Right. I'm really thinking those are going to be stuck at the end now, or something. Even if they don't import it directly, like they don't import Dan confronting and killing Azog, that they will import the idea of that scene, a major battle between a dwarf leader and a goblin leader or something. So
right.
Yes, yep. I'm feeling inexorably drawn toward an answer on our predictions question.
Yes. And I'm afraid we might end up agreeing.
Yes.
Which I guess is okay if that happens every once in a while.
Yeah.
So, okay, we should get to our official prediction question here now, because I'm starting to run out of time. So,
yep.
So our official question for this week's show is, will they conflate the Battle of Azanul Bazar with the Battle of Five Armies? And the choices are A, no, not at all. They will be depicted completely separately. B, they'll retain the idea of the Battle of Azanul Bazar, but some elements will be incorporated into the Battle of Five Armies. And C, the Battle of Azanul Bazar will be completely removed from the story, and whatever elements appear on screen will do so in the Battle of Five Armies.
And we should clarify, the difference between B and C is, by C we mean completely removed. There won't even necessarily be mention of it.
Yeah, people who haven't read the books will not know that previous major battle between the dwarves and goblins existed.
Yes, or maybe there'll be
not that one.
Yeah, there'll be a vague reference to wars and battles, right, but not this specific battle. There will be no mention of Thran being injured or Nan being killed or any of that kind of stuff.
Dwarves at the Mines of Moria or any of that.
C is basically the let's not confuse the audience with too much information answer. B is pretty broad. It could cover anything from some flashbacks and scenes to a 2-minute segment at the beginning to just naming it by name.
To a passing reference to burned dwarves.
Yes, that's right.
Make me tear up a little bit.
If they mention burned dwarves, it's B.
They mentioned burned dwarves. That totally counts as B. Not holding my breath. Just indulging a pleasant fantasy.
I'm hopeful.
my hope is small, but my desire is great to see that happen. So who's he? Who knows? My prediction is B. I wish, and you see that for the first time, I have not chosen the maximally optimistic option, but I'm still not willing to let go of optimism entirely. I hope and believe they're not going to go for the maximally streamlined thing, because I suspect that they will see the power of at least having references back to this great battle that happened before as a kind of a shortcut to giving the history of the goblins and dwarves, you know, so that they can recognize that there is serious bad blood. We're not just talking about little skirmishes. There's like a major battle in the background, and that could be used, I think, effectually for framing the Battle of Five Armies, even if they don't do it all out. So I doubt they're going to do it all out, but I think but I don't think they're going to expunge it entirely. I think it's going to be, at least I hope, it's going to be incorporated at least a bit, though I do also expect some of those elements from the Battle of Azanul Bazar to be incorporated into the Battle of Five Armies.
Yep. I'm afraid I have to agree. Our discussion and analysis was too effective this week. It just appears to me that there can be no other conclusion.
Well, sadly, I have to say that I think C is more likely than A. I wish I didn't think that, but I do.
Yeah.
but I'm still going to hold out for B.
Yep, I'm holding out for B as well. So we agree this week. Fortunately, looking at our prediction grid, I'm sure we're going to get a diversity of answers.
Yes.
The first week, we had at least one person choose every single possible answer.
Right. Though, you know, that in itself, like, if we ever do get perfect unanimity among all of the predictors, that itself will be very interesting. Because, of course, in fact, it would almost lead me to believe perversely that we must all be wrong. But anyway, yes. So we'll see. We'll see.
Yes.
Maybe we'll all agree this week. Who knows?
All right. Well, I guess you should probably go teach class now.
Yeah, I probably should. about 10 minutes.
I don't think we know what the topic will be next time. I don't know. Do you want to move on from dwarves, or do you want to go ahead and
do that? Well, we still need to talk about Thorin, so maybe it would be a good time to since we've been on these subjects, maybe it would be a good time to segue to a discussion of Thorin specifically.
Okay. If we spend half a year on dwarves, I'm fine. They don't get talked about.
Well, hey, I mean, this is the dwarf book, right?
That's right.
If we're going to do dwarves, it's time for dwarves.
Yes.
Now is the, you know, it's like when Elrond says, now is the hour of the Shire folk, right? Well, now is the hour of the dwarven folk.
That's right.
You know, when they emerge from their obscurity and
from their holes,
you know,
and kill a bunch of
as
orcs,
comic relief in the Lord of the Rings,
and cut down some trees, set themselves on
the
fire.
Stage, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us this week. This was definitely a fun show, and as I say, we've been appreciating your comments and feedback. We're always interested to think and talk about those. And we hope to have a mechanism for your contributing directly to our predictions grid soon. So anyway, keep up the comments and discussion, and we look forward to more. So thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.
We'd like to add a quick note of thanks to one of our analysts, John DiBartolo of the Lonely Mountain Band, for granting us the use of his music for the Riddles in the Dark podcast. The introduction was a selection of the Song of Durin's Awakening from the Lonely Mountain Band's Beyond the Western Seas album, and now you're listening to Expert Treasure Hunter from their new Second Breakfast album. You can find information about these albums and even download free songs from their website, lonelymountainband.com. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.